So I think the question that civic movements across the Arab world are asking is, where is the ceiling here? Is there any point at which these governments are going to start actually taking real action? So while governments may be unwilling to go further in jeopardizing what they see as their own interests, they are going to face mounting pressure from civil society, which really does want to see action taken at this point.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. The genocide in Gaza, which began in October 2023, is ongoing. Nearly the entire population has been displaced from their homes, with the majority forced into tiny areas in the south near the Rafah border with Egypt. Upwards of 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, and a third of whom are children. Many more are trapped under the rubble of their bombed homes. In the Arab world, demonstrations have taken place in Jordan, Bahrain, Yemen, Lebanon, and beyond, against this brutal assault and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Yet by and large, these demonstrations and the popular sentiment have not been represented in the form of action from their governments. Indeed, there is a very stark disconnect between the popular Arab support for Palestinian liberation and the action or inaction of the Arab regimes and leaders. To discuss this more, I'm joined by Dr. Ilham Fakhro. Ilham is a research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at Exeter University and an associate fellow at the Chatham House MENA program. She's the author of an upcoming book on the Abraham Accords and Arab normalization with Israel. Ilham, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So Ilham, obviously this is a huge topic and we can't homogenize the region into a one size fits all, but I think it would be good to try and cover as much as possible and to get an overview. So with that in mind, perhaps you can start off by giving us a summary of what the reaction to the genocide in Gaza has been amongst peoples across the region.
Absolutely. So there's been massive support for the Palestinians across the entire region. And I think that's quantifiable in three ways, actually. We've seen popular protests taking place across the Arab world, particularly, as you noted, in the countries where protests are more or less allowed. The numbers that we've seen coming out onto the streets in places like Jordan, Egypt, even Morocco, Yemen, haven't really been seen since, I would say, the Iraq War protests shook the region in 2003 and during the Second Intifada. So there's huge, huge popular mass support for the Palestinians in Arab cities. We've also seen a revival of the boycott movement, a lot of support for BDS right now, particularly targeting the brands that support occupation, that support the settlements in particular. We've seen Starbucks targeted, McDonald's, even lesser known brands like Caribou Coffee. People do their research. Caribou, for example, operates in the settlements and people have targeted them as a result. So it's a really expansive boycott movement. Even Joe and the Juice, you know, which is not a usual target for these movements, has also been targeted for boycott in places like Bahrain. So people on social media are really raising awareness of this. They're educating themselves when access to this information just isn't available on usual media networks and on the mainstream media. And we're also seeing evidence of this support just in polling data that's been coming out in the past few weeks. So, for example, a recent poll from the Washington Institute in Washington, D.C. found that 96% of Saudis now oppose normalization with Israel. This is a jump from previous numbers. Another released from the Doha Institute found that 97% of Arabs experience psychological stress from the conflict in Gaza. People are deeply, deeply affected by the devastation and the genocide that they're seeing play out on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I'll just anecdotally point out in my own experience, social media is flooded with images from Gaza, and it has been every single day for the past 3 months. People aren't letting up. You might expect there to be fatigue at this point, but there isn't. People are determined to keep awareness going and to keep pressure going as much as they can.
This popular sentiment that you've outlined for us stands in direct contrast to many of the Arab regimes and their governments who've largely been inactive. Can you tell us why this is the case and perhaps give us a few examples?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Arab states have been active merely at the level of rhetoric. They've come together, you know, during several, well, the Saudi-led summit in particular at the beginning of the war, to call for a ceasefire. They've called for eventually a return to talks around a two-state solution and for greater humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. These are the three points around which they are united. But this rhetoric really hasn't translated into any kind of meaningful action. Jordan is really the only country that has even recalled its ambassador to Israel. The other Arab states that have ambassadors haven't even gone so far as to do that. It's really a far cry when you think about the past action that's been taken at the level of, for example, the 1973 oil embargo. Arab states have been very, very timid this time around. It's clear that they're placing their own interests above the Palestinian issue. It's clear that they aren't really attentive or willing to respond to populist and popular pressures to do something about this, or at least to cut or downgrade diplomatic relations. And that's what we're seeing across the board.
Ilham, you are largely based in Bahrain. Could you tell us about what's been going on there and the protests there?
Yeah, so Bahrain has been one of the most active places on this, despite it being, you know, very small and having a smaller population relative to the rest of the Arab world. But in Bahrain, we've seen weekly protests every single Friday in support of the Palestinians. And these take two forms. There are official protests, I mean, licensed protests that are sanctioned by the government, allowed by the government. These are usually led by a society called the Bahrain Society Against Normalization with the Zionist Enemy. This was a civil society group established in 2002 during the Second Intifada to really resist any kind of normalization with Israel, whether through trade, whether through official diplomatic relations or anything like that. So this society has been organizing weekly protests. And to some extent, you know, the state tolerates it, they allow it. But I think I do have to add a caveat there that it's within carefully confined areas. So the licenses that are given for these protests are either within a closed off courtyard in Manama, this is away from public view, or they take place outside the capital. Again, outside the main highways. So this is really where we see what the government is willing to tolerate in terms of public visible dissent. There are also plenty of unauthorized protests that take place. These are organized by other political groups. Some of them have been banned in connection with the Arab Spring protests. So these organizations and groups also do organize protests. These take place usually in villages, also away from public view. And these are the ones that are more likely or are subjected to a crackdown. So people found protesting in these demonstrations have been the target of arrest. And Human Rights Watch has recently issued a report outlining the arrest of children at some of these demonstrations under the age of 18.
And why is it that Bahraini authorities allow some protests to take place and not others?
It's a great question, Yara. I think they are aware that completely banning protests around this issue would be a step too far. They, I think, are conscious that people feel very, very strongly around this issue. Perhaps there is an awareness that there needs to be some kind of release for the pressures that people face. So they do allow these protests, but I think we do need to recognize as well that that's unlikely to have an impact on public policy in the state. It's more of a sense of, okay, let the people sort of release some of the frustrations and anger that they feel around this issue, will allow it to take place away from public view. You know, none of the kind of tourists visiting the country, none of the embassy officials are going to really see any of this unless they go and look for it. None of the journalists, certainly. And so in this way, they're able to sort of balance between popular pressure and their own policy of maintaining relations with Israel.
And that's a strategy that we've seen elsewhere as well, where authorities allow for demonstrations or protests as a way to sort of release or as a release for popular outrage against the genocide. We've certainly seen that in Jordan. And you mentioned earlier that Jordan was the only regime which has relations with Israel that actually took action and expelled its Israeli ambassador. And I think Jordan's been an interesting one to follow. They obviously have to play a very delicate balancing act between their domestic and foreign considerations. The majority of the population have Palestinian backgrounds, and Jordan has seen massive protests in support of Gaza and the Palestinian struggle. And meanwhile, the Jordanian regime has a very strong relationship with the US. It's actually the second largest recipient of US aid after Israel. And so many in Jordan are actually calling for the government to do more, to actually totally cut diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime. And it's worth noting that they did endorse South Africa's ICJ genocide submission. But do you think this is as far as they will go?
We are waiting to see where the red lines are for the Arab governments. What amount of dead Palestinians are going to spur further action from them. It wasn't 10,000, it wasn't 20,000, and it isn't 30,000. So I think the question that civic movements across the Arab world are asking is, where is the ceiling here? Is there any point at which these governments are going to start actually taking real action? For Jordan, as you noted, it's very, very dependent on the United States. So is a country like Bahrain. And so governments for now are choosing to prioritize those relationships, but it is impacting civic perceptions on the ground. I mean, opposition and anger towards not only Israel, but the United States is at an all-time high right now. Even polling data reflects this. I think the earlier poll that I referenced from the Doha Institute found that 70% of Arabs, this is a poll from 16 countries, experience or are articulating anger towards the United States as well. So while governments may be unwilling to take action or go further in jeopardizing what they see as their own interests, they are going to face mounting pressure from civil society, which really does want to see action taken at this point.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. A lot of these regimes are incredibly worried about civil unrest and how this spills over into criticizing domestic policy, because I think Arabs across the region are realizing that the Palestinian struggle is directly linked to their liberation from authoritarian regimes.
This is where we see the two issues as related. Arab governments have not been responsive on the Palestinian issue, but this also kind of brings back memories or existing grievances for Arab populations on their own local demands, which is why we do see the two issues linked in the popular consciousness, I think, for many people.
So, of course, over the last few years, policy vis-a-vis the Israeli regime in the region has been characterized by the Abraham Accords, which you have extensively written about. These accords ushered in this new and, quite frankly, frightening era for the Middle East, where diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime grants all kinds of privileges, including weaponry from the US. Now, prior to October 2023, Saudi Arabia was actually poised to be next in line to normalize. And it seemed like negotiations were speeding along. What happened there? And what's likely to happen in the coming years, particularly noting that you mentioned that polling data where 96% of Saudis now oppose normalization?
Right. So the issue of Saudi normalization is a very interesting one, because most of what we do hear about this comes from US sources and it comes from Israeli sources. And I think Israeli sources in particular have always wanted to make it seem like the Arab states are on the cusp of normalization, that they're just about to, or that they want to in this case, and that they're willing to do it cost-free. Now, this was the case for the UAE and Bahrain and largely Morocco and Sudan, who entered these accords without really ensuring anything for the Palestinians. It was cost-free in that sense. But Saudi, for its part, has at least at the formal level maintained a commitment to a two-state solution and maintained its commitment to something for the Palestinians, even if that might fall short. Now, of course, there are differences between what a country sometimes declares as its formal policy and what it's willing to do. In fact, and what it's negotiating behind the scenes. But I think it is notable that Saudi Arabia hasn't yet backed down from this. And whenever asked by media sources, Saudi officials repeat the same thing. I mean, it's been the case since the start of these talks. Whenever they're asked this question, the answer is always the same. It's that we won't normalize without progress on the Palestinian issue or something akin to a two-state solution. And I think this is significant because it does show that as much as there is a lack of sort of clarity around this, there is still some level of commitment to Saudi achieving something for the Palestinians. It's not exactly the way Israeli media and Israeli officials portray it, which is that Saudi is ready to sign tomorrow. I think on the other side of it, there are also questions around U.S. commitments. I mean, Saudi Arabia has asked for a lot in return for normalization. They've asked for nuclear know-how. They've asked for advanced missile technology. And they've asked for something akin to a U.S. security pact from the United States. Whether the U.S. is prepared to deliver all of these things to Saudi in exchange for normalization is another open question. So I think even before October 7th, there were a lot of real gray areas around whether Saudi was prepared to go ahead and really go the full route. I think it's worth pointing out that Saudi also has a lot to lose if that's the case. It does risk its kind of moral authority as the leader of the Arab and Islamic world. There's a possibility that, of course, relations with Israel would inflame its existing tensions or its relationship with Iran. Saudi has been committed to de-escalating with Iran, most notably in the past year. So I don't think they want to see that be reversed through a new relationship with Israel. So where I'm getting at is Saudi has a lot to think about. It's not that straightforward. It's not that clear cut. And I don't think a deal was really as imminent as Israeli and Western officials made it seem. Now, post October 7th, I think it's even less likely. I think Saudi Arabia has to be conscious, and it is conscious of popular sentiments, not just within the kingdom around this, but within the broader Arab and Islamic world. And so this is definitely one area where we do see an impact on an Arab government, where the Gaza war has impacted the decision making of an Arab government.
One of the things that I've read that or I've seen Saudi officials doing is sort of framing normalization as strategic, not only for Saudi Arabia itself, but also for the Palestinian people. So they sort of frame it as a mechanism for leverage to achieve Palestinian rights or to move closer to a Palestinian state.
I don't think it works if you come into this and say, okay, we're going to establish the relationship and then later we're going to use it as some kind of leverage, or later we're going to use it to secure something for the Palestinians. That clearly doesn't work.
Ilham, I want to move us along because we haven't talked about Egypt yet. And Egypt plays quite a significant role. Not only has it normalized diplomatic relations with Israel several decades ago, but it's also complicit in the siege of Gaza through the Rafah border. Now, we've seen some mobilization in Egypt, noting, of course, that it's an incredibly repressive environment for political protest. But we've also seen on a diplomatic level a lot of pressure placed on Egypt by the US and by Israel. And there have been rumors that Egypt will be forced by the US and Israel to rehouse forcibly expelled Palestinians from Gaza in the Sinai. Now, Egyptian President Sisi has denied these rumors, not out of love for Palestinians, but rather because he has his own security concerns in the Sinai. What do you think about Egypt's role in all of this? And do you think that the level of outrage of the Egyptian people could have some kind of influence on government policy?
Again, like all other Arab countries, we haven't seen that happen yet. And it's not clear where the threshold lies. Egypt has, you know, been under pressure, certainly so has Jordan, to open its borders and rehouse, as you say, or voluntarily resettle, as the Israelis say, the Palestinians. It has not been willing to do that yet. Again, it's not clear if that changes down the line, but so far that's the case. And Egypt's official position towards Israel really hasn't budged, in spite of populist pressures on it to do so.
So perhaps we can turn finally to Yemen. Now, Yemen has historically been a big supporter of Palestine. The Yemeni people have been hitting the streets over the last few months in their hundreds of thousands. And Yemen has also taken direct action in opposition to the genocide in Gaza by disrupting the shipping lanes in the Red Sea. A lot of people in Palestine obviously feel like this is the kind of thing that other Arab regimes should be doing, disrupting and really, you know, making the world pay a price for their complicity in the genocide. How is this action that Yemen has taken seen across the region?
Yemen's action has been pretty extraordinary. It's one of the poorest Arab states. We all know that the conflict has been going on since 2015. It's in a dire humanitarian condition, and yet the Houthis have been able to pretty successfully impose a blockade on Israel, which no other Arab government or country has been willing to do. As a result of that, we have seen a lot of support for the Houthis from across the Arab world. Their popularity has, of course, risen. So has Hamas's popularity. I mean, one of the polls I cited earlier, the one by the Washington Institute, in fact, found a four-fold increase in support for Hamas within Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I'm sorry for emphasizing the Gulf states a bit too much, but that's the area that I usually cover. And so this is one area that people have been, I think, positively moved by it's seen in the context of sort of global solidarity for the Palestinians. Also, what we've seen with South Africa bringing the case to the ICJ, Namibia supporting that, Bangladesh supporting that. And so I think there is this fascinating sort of emergence of the global South as a point of solidarity for the Palestinians beyond just the Houthis in Yemen. And I think the US-UK-led bombardment of Yemen in response is very telling and really reinforces perceptions. This is Western support for a settler colonial state facing resistance not only from the Palestinians, but from the Arab masses and elements of the global South.
Thank you, Ilham. And I think this is really, you know, a turning point in the region. I think there's no going back from this. I think what people are increasingly realizing from Jordan to Bahrain to Yemen is that the Palestinian struggle for liberation is inherently tied to their own liberation. Support from the US in countries such as Jordan and in many of the Gulf states is really only benefiting a very small minority of the population, you know, the elites. And so people are recognizing that the situations that they're in, the hardships that they're facing, the authoritarianism that they face is ultimately tied to the Palestinian people, to the Palestinian people's struggle. And this is something that I think a lot of the Arab regimes are worried about, that this will spill over and cause instability domestically, because for so long, these regimes have really tried to isolate Palestine, to make the Palestinian struggles this sort of single issue cause, or to use it really as a political pawn. And people are, I think, refusing that understanding of Palestine and what the struggle for liberation means.
Absolutely. I think this is circling back to the issue of a lack of representation in the Arab world. This is really tying everything together. And I think if you look at Bahrain, it's a very good example. I mean, people are out on the streets, they're protesting the war in Gaza, they're protesting the US base, but they're also asking questions around their own government's policy, which they were not consulted in. Why is Bahrain participating in the naval effort to patrol the Red Sea? Nobody has been consulted on this issue. And so, yeah, what we're seeing in Gaza very much ties into right now the lack of representation across the Arab world.
Okay, Ilham, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine. We'll leave it there, but we hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you, Yara. It was great to join you.
Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.